We will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. Sorry, we're running a bit late. We had some technical difficulties. Representative Anderson, have you had a chance to check the minutes from the last time we met?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Anderson moves the minutes from the January 26th. What was the last one? Hey, Representative Anderson, we're going to hang on. We'll do the minutes in a minute from the last meeting as soon as we make sure we have the right date on there. With that, members, we have a full agenda today. We're hearing five bills, so we're going to get right into it. First one, is Representative Wardlow here? He's here. Representative Wardlow, come on down and we'll get started. Okay. Representative Wardlow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davids, would you like to move this bill for Representative Wardlow?
I'd be honored to. So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. House File 395 is now in front of us. Representative Wardlow, fire away. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could we have Representative Davids explain the bill he just moved?
Well, we're going to get to that, Representative Mullery. If Representative Wardlow doesn't cover everything, Representative Davids will get it. He's on it. So thank you for your...
Davids will add the technical legal things to it.
Absolutely. That's what we count on him for. Representative Wardlow, fire away whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 395 is a real property technical bill. And I think the portion of the bill that's within the purview of this committee is Section 6 regarding a reverse mortgage redemption period. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Kevin Dunleavy to give an explanation.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. And my committee, our job is to work on facilitating laws to protect good faith purchasers and to make title marketable in Minnesota. This particular legislation was brought to our attention because reverse mortgages are unlike conventional mortgages. Conventional mortgages, the redemption period is calculated by how much principal is left on the mortgage. So if it's a $100,000 mortgage, if it's less than $60,000, it's a 12-month redemption. If it's more than I think $66,000, it's a 6-month redemption period. Reverse mortgages aren't like that. It's not a single draw. It's a pay over time. Actually, it's the lender paying the borrower over time. And so that formula based on the principal balance doesn't really make sense. The practitioners who do mortgage foreclosures of reverse mortgages typically use a 12-month redemption period, but this gives statutory authority for that, because if the redemption period is wrong in a foreclosure, the foreclosure is void. So in order to remove uncertainty of title, this is just declaring that for all reverse mortgages, it's the longer, the 12-month redemption period.
Members, any questions? Representative Wardlow, anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that sums it up. It's a Bar Association supporter bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Davids.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Mullery, there you go. Representative Davids was on it, as you expected.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Davids forgot to discuss the other parts of the bill. Aren't we on 395?
Yes. What do you...
Representative Mullery, we are on 395. We're trying to only talk about the commerce stuff to limit the scope of where we are and what we're looking at today. But good catch. Representative Davids was just about to let you know that.
I thought so.
Members, any questions on the bill, on the bill that's before us on the commerce-related parts? Representative Wardlow, do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience that's here to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, with that, Representative Davids renews his motion that House File 395 be passed and sent to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Wardlow, congratulations. It's on the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Mm-hmm.
We're going to jump off of the agenda a little bit. We're going to switch around. Representative Hackbarth, if it's all right with you, we'll go ahead and do your bill. House File 434. And I will, while Representative Hackbarth is coming down, I will move House File 434 so it's before us. Representative Hackbarth and Mr. Krogman, whenever you're ready, go ahead. And Mr. Krogman, we did, I talked to Dan, and I know you and I had talked ahead of time, but I think we should try to send this to Environment, and we can talk to Representative McNamara. If he doesn't want to see it, we can amend it and send it to the General Register. Is that okay, Representative Hackbarth?
That's fine, Mr. Chairman. That's
perfect. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is the petrol fund bill. It's a... I've carried this bill before, and I have with me today Mr. Krogman that can explain the bill and exactly what happens with this. But this is the petrol fund tank cleanup bill, and it was put in place a number of years ago to create kind of almost like a savings account, kind of to clean up tanks, bills, and petroleum that leaks into the ground, those kinds of things, and cleans up those hazardous waste sites and hazardous spills. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if you'd allow me to turn it over to Mr. Krogman, and he can explain what we're doing here.
Sounds good to me. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Mr. Krogman, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our folks own and operate local convenience stores, gas stations, deliver fuel to farms, heating oil, a variety of different fuels are sold to end users. The first part of the bill that seems the most important is extending the sunset provision by 5 years, and it extends an existing program that's covered real well in the overview. And the extension of the sunset has been an ongoing thing. The idea when the sunset was first put there was that at some point there may be an insurance mechanism available that would meet the federal and state requirements for financial assurance. The commissioner reviews it, has reviewed it every time before a proposal to the extension of the sunset, and frankly those products that would both be available and work are not quite there, are not there yet. There are some states who have gone to private insurance, and a couple of them are now looking at reinstituting a state fund. The other part of the bill would take a threshold off on 1 million gallons of storage for petroleum products, which, and this mentions used oil, but it also would include people who handle used oil and refined products. That original million gallon threshold was put in there at when it was first passed, so the petrol fund wouldn't be spent out cleaning up refineries and pipeline terminals. The 1 million gallons seemed like a good number. What's going on now is that there are people who collect used oil, they store it all winter long, and then they sell it during the summer months to hot mix plants. That's the best market for it. There's been a slowdown in construction. They've been holding more oil. These folks are also the ones who have set up the tanks at city, county, state garages and collect the do-it-yourself oil. They can't hardly shut those down, so they pick up oil all year long, store it, and sell it during the summer. This gives them coverage under the petrol fund for both the used oil and the gasoline and diesel fuel tanks they have at stations and bulk plants. Mr. Chairman, I'd answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Krogman. Any questions, members? Anybody else you want to have testify, Representative Hackbarth?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if there are any other questions, the department's here too, and they can speak to anything that anyone might have also.
I don't see any questions. Is there anyone in the audience, anyone else that would like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File, just covered it up.
434.
434 pass and be referred to the Environment Committee. And I will talk to Representative McNamara, and if he doesn't want it, we'll make a motion on the floor to re-refer it to the General Register or wherever else they think it has to go. With that, I have renewed the motion. Those in favor of those voting aye, or those in favor of this bill, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative McCarthy. Mr. Krogman.
Members.
Next up, Mr. Representative Sanders. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to pass House File 562 to civil law.
Very good. The bill is before us. Please proceed when you're ready. Identify yourself for the record and let it go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Tim Sanders. Today I bring before you House File 562. This bill is threefold in purpose. Number one, it promotes equity, two, cost savings, and three, conservation. This bill is needed to permit manufactured home park owners to modify their lease agreements and permit them, should they choose so, to install water submeters at their expense. Submetering means that residents pay for what they use, and really that gets around not subsidizing the use of their neighbors. For instance, when I moved to Minnesota, I purchased a manufactured home and lived in one all through college, was single, not working, or while working and being in school, not home much, not using a lot of water or sewage at the house. After I graduated, got married, wife moved in, we started to use more water, as families continue to grow. Conversely, my neighbor across the street, severely disabled, used very little water, very fixed income, yet we paid the same amount for water and sewage rates. What the purpose of this bill is to make sure that we are promoting equity in between the neighbors here and save money for the residents as well as the park owners and conserve water resources. We've worked with the Manufactured Home Association. We also have the support of the North Country Co-op. We are currently working with Legal Aid and Mr. Elwood to address some concerns that he has, and we are confident working out an agreement with him and also with the League of Cities to address some concerns that they have raised. I have Mark Bruner, the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, with me in the audience today, as well as sitting next to me, Mr. Mark Lambert, who is a park owner, attorney, and helped draft this bill. With that, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, like Mr. Lambert, just to say a few words and then turn the bill back over to you.
That sounds good. Identify yourself for the record.
Mark
please
Lambert,
proceed.
Representative Hoppe, chair members. This is a sorely needed piece of legislation for us community owners. I have six communities and have not been able to submeter. As you know, the issue becomes if it's a public good, there's no incentive to conserve. And what we're hoping here is by moving this legislation through, that ultimately we'll be able to submeter residents so that the grandmas and the folks that don't use much water don't have to pay large rates. Those that are using much water have an incentive to conserve and better utilize their rates. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions? With that, I think I see Mr. Elwood coming down who would like to speak to the bill. Mr. Elwood, please identify yourself for the record and share with us your feelings about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Thanks for the opportunity to say a few words. First of all, I want to thank the Manufactured Home Park Owners Association, Mr. Bruner and Mr. LeBeau, because they have given us a heads up before they came forward with this bill to give us a chance to take a look at it. And they have sat down with us twice so far to address some of the concerns we have. I'm confident that when this bill finally hits the floor, they will, and we will all come to an agreement. So thank them for that. I do want to raise one issue that I hope won't be a sticking point, but if it is, would be a serious roadblock for our to get our support, which would be the issue of how to address the private well issue. I can tell you that in years past, when this bill has come forward before, the residents were unalterably opposed to this approach. But that things have changed over time, and the residents are not necessarily opposed to submetering, assuming that the appropriate consumer protections are in place. And as you may notice if you've read the bill, the park owners, I think, did a really good job at a first pass in putting in some of those consumer protections. We are suggesting more, which they're not necessarily opposed to. But the issue of the private wells and how to deal with that is something that we're going to have to talk about as we move forward. But I would urge the committee to move the bill through the committee and keep it going, and let us talk about it and try to get to a handshake agreement at the end. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. The members, any questions for Mr. Elwood? And thank you for understanding, for saying everything you did and talking about it being a work in progress. We will, I think, pass it out and send it on, and you guys can keep working on it before it gets to civil law and after. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Sanders will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, it is something that we are continuing to work on. We do believe that we can come to an excellent agreement. Again, we really do believe that once agreed to, this bill will still promote equity, tremendous cost savings, and really focus on conservation as well. So with that, I ask for member support, and as we pass House File 562 on the civil law.
Thank you. No questions from anybody. Members, those in favor of House Files passing 562 and sending it on to civil law, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders, and all your testifiers. Representative Murdoch, you ready? House File 342. Whenever you're ready, Representative Murdoch, identify yourself for the record, and you can go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark Murdoch, District 10B. And I'd like to move House File 342, recommended to pass, and we're going to jobs, I believe, after this one. There's an amendment in the packet. We're not going to deal with that today,
okay.
So you can disregard that.
That's our favorite kind of amendment.
quick and easy ones, right? Quick and easy ones. What House File 342 does is allows for the inspection of manufactured homes in non-code areas in outstate Minnesota. Right now, the Department of Labor and Industry has to send their people out to inspect these homes at a cost. And this will let second and third party inspectors go into the rural non-code areas and inspect these homes. It's going to speed the process up, and we've met with the commissioner there in my office last week. We had a few laughs, had a good time, and addressed some issues that they had. And in fact, I think Mark and Reed met with them today, and we're continuing to iron out some things, and that's why we're not doing the amendment today. We'll do that in jobs. But anyway, Mark Bruner is here to explain the bill in a little more detail and answer questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Murdoch. So it's our understanding that this is another work in progress, and negotiations will continue before it gets to jobs.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Go ahead and proceed whenever. Identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Mark Bruner. I'm the president of Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. And this issue really came to us last fall when the Department of Labor and Industry met with us and told us because of declining home sales in the state, they were projecting a loss of about $500,000 in terms of their inspections for new manufactured homes. In the past, we had sold maybe 3,000-4,000 homes a year. They were anticipating we'd be down to about 500 or 700 homes. We'd had an $80 inspection fee that was charged for each home in the non-code areas. The way the program works, the department is a state administrative agency for HUD in that all new manufactured homes are built to the federal building code or the HUD code. And the state of Minnesota is responsible for inspecting those homes when they're installed on the home site. They're inspected in the plant by inspectors, but when they're transported to the home site and put on a basement or a foundation, the department's responsible for that in the non-code areas of Minnesota. In the code areas of Minnesota, the local building officials are responsible for doing those inspections. So the issue became for the department one of being able to actually send their people from St. Paul to do the inspections in the non-code areas, and there were so few homes to inspect. The economies of scale were no longer there. We, in talking to the department and then the meeting with our membership and then Representative Murdoch and others, had come up with an alternative proposal, which would be to allow local building officials who are already doing the manufactured home inspections in their municipalities to do those same inspections outside of their municipality for essentially the same fee that they're charging plus travel expenses, rather than have the department have to pull back and not do the program, which would have resulted in HUD having to come in and do the inspections with their team out of Washington, which would have been a huge expense as well. We have in Minnesota, we have 8 plants that build manufactured and modular homes. 4 of those build manufactured homes and modular. The others all build modular. So it's an important concern for the industry that we'd be able to get the homes inspected. And we've since met with the department, and they are now on board with where we're headed. They've got another sort of approach they're bringing in that would allow some third parties to start inspecting as well. Homes in non-code areas, so it is a work in progress, but we're hoping to continue on as the bill moves forward.
Very good, Mr. Bruner. Representative Murdoch, do you have any other testifiers? Anybody here that you want to have speak? Anybody you know wants to speak against it?
Not that I know, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Well, any members have any questions for Representative Murdoch? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I swear, no, we're not taking up the amendment. There's a blank fee on there. But on the bill on line 518, there's an additional fee of blank is going to be charged. Do we know what that is, or is that going to be added later on? I mean, I'm probably not on this committee, but...
Mr. Bruner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson. In a matter of fact, we discussed that this morning with the department. And that will probably be coming out of the bill when there's an author's amendment based on some additional authority that the department has in terms of using an existing fee and just breaking it out a little differently. But the intent was, when it was drafted, to allow part of a fee to come back to the department for updating the building code and providing continuing education for building inspectors on the manufactured home code. So my guess is that they will use their existing authority right now, and there won't be necessarily an additional fee.
Representative Nelson.
Well, do you know what that existing fee is? Or?
Well, the existing fee right now is $80.
Thank you.
Got it. And again, that will be, you said that's something that will come out with an author's amendment, and I assume it would be something that's okay with the department?
Yes, we'll work with the department on it.
Okay. Other questions, members? If not, Representative Murdoch renews his motion that House File 342 be passed and moved to the Jobs Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Murdoch and Mr. Bruner.
Yep. Thank you, members.
Representative Downey, whenever you're ready. Representative Downey, whenever you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Before we do that, I almost forgot again. And I apologize to the members of the committee. I've had some technical issues here, entirely my fault. The minutes had a typo on it. It should be February 9th instead of January 26th. So, Representative Stensrud, now that I've informed you about that typo, I know you've had a chance to look at these minutes. Would you go ahead and move the minutes if they meet your approval?
They meet my approval. I would move those.
Any questions regarding the minutes with the typo fix, the minutes as amended? Seeing none, those in favor of Representative Stensrud's motion to approve the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Congratulations, Representative Stensrud. Thank you for your help. Okay, Representative Downey, I will go ahead and move your bill, move House File 288, be recommended to pass, and move on to the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. With that, Representative Downey, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. If I could make just a few brief introductory comments, sure. And then I would like to have Paul Cassidy maybe walk through a bigger backdrop on this bill. This bill has had a little bit of life in the legislature, something that was proposed by Representative Winkler in the last session. It was also in the governor's budget, given that we were at that point, I think, more focused on the angel investment tax credit. This CAPCO investment tax credit got left behind, and here it is back again, I think, a worthy vehicle for trying to drive early stage investment in Minnesota. So with that little bit of history, for many of you this isn't new. For those of you who are here for the first time, it will be new, and we'll spend a little bit of time walking through the particulars of the bill too. But let me just set the stage for this, and I know those who are on the Small Business Caucus, who've been on Commerce, who've been on taxes, have heard a lot of these kind of stories before. But Minnesota historically has been a real engine of startups, and there has been a very robust kind of early stage community here in Minnesota. Very intelligent venture capital, people who are very experienced in starting companies and growing them. A wealth of talent, both at the board level and in terms of company executives here in Minnesota that have done these things before, who know how to do them. And then on top of that, we've got just a lot of native economic strengths, medical technology industry, other kind of native strengths around water and filtration and these things. And so Minnesota historically has really been an engine for early stage growth, witness the Medtronics and some of the other companies that have been spawned here in the last 30, 40 years in Minnesota. But what's happened is by virtue of private equity markets in general, collapse is too strong a word, but they have tightened markedly here in the last 10 years, 15 years. The competition from the coasts has been great. Not only have we had a harder time starting and launching companies, but maybe even more pronounced has been our ability to retain them here in Minnesota. And as they grow and move from startup to actually generating a profit and paying taxes as a corporate entity, they leave. And so there's been a recognition, I think, in the legislature that doing some things that other states have been doing, frankly, that might not seem super attractive to many of us in terms of, you know, state policy trying to drive investment in the private sector. But other states have been offering credits to angel investors. They've been building these CAPCO kinds of programs. And so Minnesota has been at a competitive disadvantage, even with their neighbors across the border, in not having these programs. So the angel investor tax credit, which we passed last year, bipartisan effort, and this bill have been in the mix, and I'd like to introduce this bill and see if we can't get this through this year to drive even more investment in early stage companies here. The basic premise of the angel investor tax credit was for early stage companies, the ones where you're trying to get your friends and neighbors and family and maybe some close banking relationships, individuals, to make investments in your company. The angel investor tax credit provided an incentive comparable to what other states were doing to address those business. This bill is a little bit more oriented towards those who are interested in putting more capital into their business. So maybe not the earliest stage, but that next stage where you're still before really being able to appeal to a venture capital firm or any kind of an institutional round of equity raising through banks, et cetera, to fill in that little bridge there between the early stage investment rounds and where you just need more capital to get through your FDA approvals or whatever it might be. This bill would provide an incentive for insurance companies to invest a portion of their reserves in those types of companies in exchange for a premium tax credit. And so with that big backdrop, I will hand it over to Mr. Cassidy, who can give you a little more background, some of the experiences of other states, and some of the particulars on this program.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard. I'm here today to in support of House File 288 and also here on behalf of our clients, Enhanced Capital Partners and Advantage Capital. They are two firms that have been working on this issue for the past 12 years in a number of jurisdictions around the country. This proposal, we believe, addresses this committee's primary focus, which is immediate job creation that results in a growing tax base. To accomplish this, we need to provide incentives to unlock capital, like Representative Downey was alluding to, and if you will, for those that need it, those businesses that need it. The economic development tool under consideration today has a proven track record in many states, including New York, Texas, Missouri, and Wisconsin. It was recently passed in Tennessee and Connecticut. Wisconsin Governor Walker is asking for reauthorization of the Wisconsin program to the tune of $200 million in his economic development package. It's an economic development tool that comes at a time when our economic conditions have caused credit markets to tighten, if not seize up. This proposal is fairly straightforward. It's simple and addresses a real need in the marketplace. The Small Business Investment Act channels $200 million to growing Minnesota businesses so that they can expand their operations and grow jobs in our state. To accomplish this, the Small Business Act would have the Department of Economic Development license and regulate investment managers, such as our client Enhanced Capital, have them go out and pool the resources of insurance companies into a $200 million investment pool. The investment managers invest those funds in local growing businesses who may be having a difficult time finding financing. In exchange for this, in exchange for the insurer providing the initial capital for the investment fund, the insurer would receive a tax credit against their premium tax obligation, but only after meeting certain funding and certain other criteria and thresholds that have been built into the law. The tax credits don't kick in for 4 years until 2015. Assuming all the requirements of the legislation have been met, the tax credits will be paid out over 4 years in 20% increments. The tax credits would be forfeited if the investment manager does not invest the funds in qualifying investments, and there would be no profits taken out until 100% of the funds have been invested as well. As I stated earlier, this program has a proven track record in other states. It's been authorized in 14 jurisdictions around the country. It's been reauthorized 38 times. Texas has reauthorized the program 3 times. New York is on their 4th round of funding. The state of Wisconsin is going through another round of funding, as well as Missouri. At the moment, the supporters of this legislation include the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Business Partnership, the High Tech Association, Life Science Alley, the NFIB. Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions and any specifics about the legislation before you.
Members, any questions? Looks like a bunch of questions. Representative Tilbury.
Yeah, this is a question for Representative Downey. Would this bill, and I know it'll probably go to other committees, but when it comes to the tax committee, will it be considered a tax expenditure?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Tilbury, I don't know. I'm guessing that it would. It would be technically a credit against the insurance company premium tax and would fit into that category of tax expenditures.
Representative Tilbury.
Yeah, another follow-up question with that is, and as the bill progresses and goes on, are you going to propose a way to pay for that?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Tilbury, yes, it would be part of whatever comes out of the tax committee.
So it would be considered a tax expenditure, which will cost more than the $6.2 billion deficit that we have.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tilbury, it technically won't. To do a fiscal note on this bill right now, it'll come back zeros for the next 4 years, so the next two biennia, because the actual credit is not paid out until kind of the performance of the investments starting in year 2015.
Representative Tilbury, is that it?
That's it.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, I see last year the bill was $100 million, and now you've raised it to $200 million, but over 4 years. In the Small Business Caucus, we talked a lot about Minnesota being competitive, and we believe that we ought to be competitive in what in the area of entrepreneurial activity in the with our neighbors. Do you have any idea what the neighbors are doing, Wisconsin and any others, as far as the number?
Representative Downey or Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to my knowledge at the moment, the states that are taking this up in terms of reauthorizations, number one is New York. Number two, Wisconsin's governor has proposed this.
Yep.
So those are the proposals on the table. There could very well be other states that will take this up this session as well, or this year as well. As I stated earlier, 14 states have passed this, including the District of Columbia. It's been reauthorized 38 times around the country as well.
Representative Diedrich.
Thank you. And to that point, do you have any idea what the neighbors are contributing, what their cost is? Ours will be $50 million a year, or does it not have to take $50 million a year? Can it be, is that just a four-year period that you, up to $200 million? I'm just wondering what what the state of Wisconsin has Absolutely. Contributed to this.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Diedrich, different states have had different allocations.
Right.
We did do $100 million last year in our proposal. I think we actually raised it to $200 million during the legislative process. Other states have done two. Some states have done 75. I'm looking at a chart, which I believe you have in your packet, which a number of states. It's a chart that looks like this, gray bars across. It shows you how much tax credits have been allocated in different states, as well as the tax credit each year. Some states have actually had 100%, most of these programs have had 100% tax credit. Many of them have had the tax credits kick in immediately the first year, and then have been measured out over years. But there are different variations. States have approached this a little bit differently, state by state.
Representative Diedrich,
you can very well start out small.
Yeah, so Representative Diedrich. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I reading this right, that Wisconsin would be at $50 million a year then?
Correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Downey.
Just one point of clarification, and I do have the A1 amendment that actually changes the dollar amounts on page 5, line 31 and 32. While it is a $200 million program, because it's an 80% of that credit, the actual tax expenditure is $160 million. So it's $40 million per year, not 50, just to be clear in terms of what will show up here.
Representative Downey, do you want me to move this amendment? Do you want to do this today?
Mr. Chair, if okay. I could, or if you could, that would be great. Thank you.
Do members have other questions before we move the amendment? Seeing none, I will move the A1 amendment, and we can have discussion on the amendment before we vote on it. Members, does everyone have a copy of the amendment?
No.
Mr. Okay. Chair?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As it's being passed around, maybe I can just give you a quick sure. synopsis. It's a pretty simple amendment. The main component is what I just mentioned to you, the more accurate reflection of the state's refund costs as compared to the overall dollar value of the program. And then the other provision, you'll notice in Section 3 on page 13 of the original bill, there was an appropriation to the Department of Employment and Economic Development to handle the startup for the program. This language changes it so that the certification fees paid by the people participating in the program actually goes to cover deeds costs as compared to a general fund appropriation.
Thank you. Representative Diedrich, does this answer some of your questions about costs and funding? And
yes, it does, Mr. Chairman, so thank you. But I just want to also point out that we are competitive with Wisconsin, but still lag behind many of the other states. If I'm reading this correctly.
Members, any other questions to the amendment? Representative Anzels, do you have a question? No other questions. We'll go ahead and vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
We have motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. We're back on the bill as amended. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't had a chance to analyze what this means, but just real quick, I noticed New York has 400 allocated and Wisconsin 50, and yet only twice as many jobs. Can you explain that real quick? Or I know that I haven't had time to analyze what this means, but that just jumped out at me.
Either Mr. Cassidy or Representative Downey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, I just think it reflects a different success in different programs in terms of the ratio of jobs that they were able to produce.
Because it's eight times as big and only twice as many jobs, I just wondered.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Mullery, that's a good question, and it's going to go, when it leaves here, go to jobs, and I would assume it's going to have at least a couple of more committee stops along the way. Representative Downing, maybe that's one of the things you can find out and let Representative Mullery know. It seems to be a good question. Other questions? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the question, it kind of builds on what Representative Mullery had asked about, and I had it, Representative Downey, even before. I think I support the bill. I think it's a great idea. I've seen the success it's had in other states. Where we're missing a little something, and it's not enough to keep it in the committee, but is the particulars of the programs that have been used elsewhere. And I think if y'all can just, maybe as the bill continues to move, give us a sense of the particulars that are driving, because it's a pretty distinct difference between a Wisconsin and a New York, where the money that's being spent is generating on a proportion basis considerably fewer jobs in New York than what it's doing in Wisconsin. And if ours is modeled after the ones that are most successful, obviously that's more helpful than one that isn't. My overarching question is somewhat like Representative Dietrich's as well, and is our program going to be, in terms of the particulars, more generous, less generous than those states that we're competing with? And if you can answer that today, that's great, but that's more of a, as we move through the process, kind of question, because I do think it's a valuable program. I also wanted you to confirm for us, of course, it is a vehicle bill for the Viking Stadium. Is that that's just what I know. I'm kidding, but it looks like it's had great success elsewhere, and it's more just a matter of the particulars. What makes up the engine?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, what I can tell you is that this legislation before you represents a lot of lessons learned over the past 12 years, a lot of bumps in the road, a few bumps in the road, but a lot of successes as well. For instance, a portion of the bill that addresses thresholds that the investment managers have to meet so you actually get the money on the street. Now you got to be careful that you're not pushing investment managers to make bad decisions because of timelines. But their thresholds that you, I mean, what you want is you want money in the pipeline and job growth as fast as possible. Now, from state to state, there's been variations on this theme in terms of 100% tax credit, 80% tax credit, but by and large, 100%. It's been measured out over different timelines as well. Secondly, on the success issue, on different success state by state, I have a Bible of studies and audited studies that have to be handed in each year by these firms that are given to whatever state authority they're governed by, that I can share with you and point out, you know, why certain ones were more successful than the others, and I will do that. I will share that with you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add a couple of things. I'm trying to remember all of the points of variation between the different states, but there's four at least that are the key drivers, and the first is the total dollar investment. The second is the time frame required in the legislation that pushes deployment of those dollars. The third is the time to receive the credit, the lag time between which the investment is made and when the credit is earned. And then the last is the percent of the credit. And I think, based on what we've watched specifically, I think in Tennessee, as they've kind of reauthorized and maybe become a little bit more of the model here, is you probably don't want to be on the front end of aggressiveness, and you don't want to be on the back end. As Mr. Cassidy mentioned, if you're on the front end of aggressiveness, you actually could push this money to chase higher risk deals or bad deals. If you're on the back end, you probably don't have enough juice behind it to really make it work. So I think we've got this more or less right in the middle in terms of those four variables. You know, Minnesota has, again, we aren't starting from scratch here. I think we have in our broader regional economy, I think we have muscles that have been flexed in this regard before. This is not new behavior. These are not new concepts. It's not as though we're looking for new talent and new ideas or companies to spin on. We've got a lot of the building blocks sitting here, and it's just the infusion of this capital that starts to energize all the stuff that's just sitting there waiting for that infusion.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Downey, I'm just thinking it looks kind of like the reason that we're not having this till 2015 is the effect of a revenue note and the tails. And but on the other hand, right now is when we need the jobs. And so it seems like a balancing due if you're avoiding a revenue note that's negative. On the other hand, right now we need the jobs. Isn't that kind of an offset, or how do you determine which way to go on that?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, our client and their clients, the insurance companies, would be more than happy to get paid the tax credits the first year, but it does work this way. The financials work for them to delay this for 4 years. They've done the program in between 0 and 4 years as well. But it does work for 4 years. In fact, it works even for some of these programs. It's worked for even longer, delay.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mullery,
wouldn't it work better? I don't know. What's the experience in other states? Would it work better if we had the credit sooner, as far as getting jobs right now?
Mr. Cassidy,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I don't want to tie the credits too closely to the job creation. The point is that the existence of the tax credits are incenting the insurance companies to be the investors, put that money out on the street. Immediately.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I understood that. I just wondered what the experience was in other states as far as that.
And Representative
Maybe you
Downey,
don't have any idea.
I don't have a good answer for that.
Maybe that's one of the things we can check in answer to Representative Dietrich and Atkins and everybody else's questions. And just try to find out what other states have had the experience of.
Mr. Chair, could I add one more comment to
sure, Representative
Mullery's question? And I think that's a great piece of data. Let's go a little bit deeper into these statewide programs and see what their factors may have been relative to these kinds of results. But, you know, there was a time, probably 10 years ago, maybe 12, when if you were a private equity firm, building funds to invest in some kind of a portfolio of companies or real estate or whatever it might have been, you were actually looking for exit strategies, some of them literally in 2 years, 3 years. It was off the charts in terms of the speed with which people wanted to turn their investments. And I think right now, given the way things are, that we are wiser to take a little bit more moderated approach. And if you look, sorry, I'm going to struggle here to find the exact page in the bill. There is a section of the bill that shows that prescribes how quickly. It's subdivision 5 on page 7. There's 2, 3, 4, and 6 year benchmarks here in terms of what percent of the total fund that the investment company builds, in terms of how fast it has to be deployed into investments. And so I think we've structured this bill to not be on the hot, highest risk end of investment portfolios, but to be maybe more in the middle. And I think that fits the kind of companies we have, and I think it fits the times.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things when I read the bill that I was actually kind of intrigued by was that we weren't going to be giving the investment credit in the first years. I think that builds a commitment from the investor not to do some due diligence on seeing whether the company has viability as an idea and an option. If we give the credits, as was suggested, in the first 2 or 3 years, it might be just like spinning the roulette wheel. Did we win this time? Did we not win this time? And then take taxpayer dollars and put those out in maybe some ill-gotten ventures. So I kind of like that idea. And then the other thing that I was just reading the bill was, it seemed like we got going on this now, we may be able to see some prosperity from these jobs. which could also help fill the state coffers, which could help us to backfill the tax credits with some revenue to the state. So I kind of thought that was maybe the intention of the bill. If not, it was how I perceived the bill, but I just thought I would share that as a comment.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that?
Representative Downey.
So a couple of things. I think you're exactly right. Going a little bit more in the moderate zone means you don't have people turning investments just to turn financial paper. And you'll notice that the requirements for investing in Minnesota-based companies means that we're really looking for Minnesota jobs, and a longer-term investment horizon, I think, tends to create a slightly more stable job picture out of these investments as well. And to your point about the return on investment to the state, you know, we can't dynamically score this proposal in taxes to say, well, if we created, you know, a similar number of jobs here as we did across the average of these other states, what would that mean in tax revenue? But clearly states aren't doing this because it's just a net loss. I mean, there is a return. And if you'll notice in Subdivision 7 on page 9, line 9.24, I think that's accurate, at least that's on my the version I'm operating off of. We also require that the investment companies return 10% of the net profits to the state. So one of those areas where we're actually intentionally carving out some return on investment for the state above and beyond what would accrue to the state from tax revenues and the jobs.
Thank you, Representative Downey. And members, I think this has been a good discussion. We're a little far afield from commerce into tax areas, but that's okay. We'll straighten them out, too. Any other questions, members? Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, this feels like a risky endeavor to me. But I can't quite figure out where the risk resides in the event of bad things happening. Can you just talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anzels, I think that's a great observation, and a lot of large institutional investors, including state investment boards, have in a really controlled way started to put a portion of their overall investment portfolio into what arguably are higher risk, higher return types of private equity investments. And they do that in a small enough amount that if they do realize the worst of the risk-reward continuum, that it's not detrimental and damaging to the overall portfolio. And so, you know, we have our Minnesota Investment Board has a small private equity kind of capital deployment with some of our funds, and I think it's just a really common thing to do. When the stock market returns tipped upside down, again, maybe 6-8 years ago, we had some fairly average returns, and a lot of investors turned heavily towards private equity, you know, investing their capital directly into small businesses like this. And I think it got up a little too high and a little too hot, and now it's down to where it's probably below where it should. So I think the dollar amount, when we look at the overall risk exposure to the state, is probably the right amount. And I think the way we've balanced the risk between state taxpayers, the investment companies, and the companies that actually receive this. If you look through at some of the penalty provisions for, you know, investing this too fast, if you look at some of the penalties and things, I think we've got the risk managed. I hope we do, and I think it's the experience of other states that it's been done in a balanced way, too. So absolutely accurate observation. This is a higher risk chunk of somebody's portfolio, but I think we've got it managed and compartmentalized in the right
way. Thank you.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, what I'd add to Representative Downey's comments are, number one, off the bat, insurers are just inherently risk-averse, and they would not invest in this program and continue to invest in the program unless it was successful. Number two, you're only good as your last program, and this program's been reauthorized again and again and again over the last 12 years. This is managed; these investments are managed by professional investors who need to succeed. They need to turn a profit. They need the businesses to become successful. That's why this program is different. It's taken the economic development model out of a government agency and put it in private hands, people that have an incentive to succeed.
And thank you, Mr. Cassidy. And Representative Anzels and Mr. Cassidy, on page 8 of the bill, line 8.3, paragraph F, a Minnesota business investment company may not invest more than 15% of its designated capital in one qualified. So, and I'd like to point out that since that went over with nobody criticizing me, actually that was from Ms. Newman. So, had it gone wrong, I would have taken the blame. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to congratulate Representative Downey for bringing this forward. I'm co-author of the bill, so obviously I support the concept, but I wanted to ask, and maybe Mr. Cassidy would have this. I know we do have some reporting requirements with regards to characteristics of the investment with the number of jobs created in that, so we can kind of track the success of this, if you will, in terms of employment. I'm curious to know kind of what happens in other states that have this kind of program, and what do they collect additional types of information, whether it's salary ranges for the jobs created or anything else?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it really is all over the map. I mean, in terms of the criteria, some of it's pretty prescriptive. I think this is very prescriptive in terms of, and thorough. If there's any additional reporting requirements that you as the legislature see fit that should go in the bill, we're open for suggestions.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loon. First of all, I don't deserve much credit at all on this bill. I'm pleased to be able to author it. Representative Winkler and many others have advanced this ball for years before I'm authoring it here. Observation or answer to your question about tracking this data, I think this is the exact same language that we had in the Angel Investment Tax Credit Bill, and their report, and it's really early because they're only 1 year into it, but their report is due out literally in the next couple of weeks, maybe mid-March. So we'll have a report back from them very similar to this, and whatever we learn from what they're reporting on, we could obviously weave that into this bill too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that's, you know, hopefully will be some measure of comfort for members who are wondering about Minnesota getting into this, because and clearly there's a good track record of other states, but I think having this data follow on those investments will be helpful.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else that would like to speak? Come on up. Identify yourself for the record when you get there, and proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and to be totally honest, I didn't plan on testifying today. I was actually upstairs in a very good jobs bill.
Well, we're glad you're here.
We do have to renew our opposition to the what's commonly known as CAPCO in some circles. And I actually have testimony on my phone, so bear with me. As Representative Downey and the gentleman has stated, this is not a new idea. And in other states, this isn't substantially different than what's been going on in other states. It has been proven ineffective and in generating startup businesses, and widely subject to having the dollars siphoned off for windfall purposes other than job creation. It has proven to be an extraordinarily wasteful use of taxpayers' dollars, and in difficult budget times, the legislature should be focused on best practices, not failed practices. Certified capital companies, or CAPCOs, as it's known in other states, Greg LeRoy, director of the research group, Good Jobs First, provided a detailed review of the defects of this device in his book, The Great American Job Scam. The state of Florida, for example, allocated $150 million to this program. The audit 9 years later found the program had created a net gain of 20 jobs. In Colorado, Bob Lee, head of the state's Office of Economic Development, which administers the program, told a legislative committee, "I think this state would be hard-pressed to design a program that cost the taxpayers more and delivered less." A state study in Missouri found that 66% of the funds were not used for the intended purposes of providing capital for startup or expanding Missouri businesses. In 2004, an audit by then Missouri State Auditor Claire McCaskill concluded the program was ineffective and should be allowed to expire. I would thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Any questions, members? Thank you for coming down, and we appreciate you being here instead of upstairs. Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, may we get some of the copies of those reports that you just referred to, Ms. Schaubach? That would be great. Thank you.
Good point. Mr. Hesse, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And the Minnesota Chamber has supported the legislation that's in front of you today for a number of years. And we do so for one simple reason, and maybe just a couple of minutes on the Chamber's Grow Minnesota program will help you understand that. And we have a private sector economic development program called Grow Minnesota, which tries to visit a number of companies, 800 or so each year, and figure out what it takes for them to stay in Minnesota, grow here, invest more, employ more people. 2 years ago, we were lucky enough to receive a $5.5 million grant from the Pollat Family Foundation to turn around and help small companies that were having a difficult time navigating the recession so they could stay in business. Through our Grow Minnesota program, you put the word out that we have these funds. We had $75 million of requests for the $5.5 million that we had to offer. So there's clearly a need and a gap of small business capital in the state, and we think this provision, this legislation, can help fill that gap. And for that reason, we strongly support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Any questions, Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I just wanted to point out the previous testifier, I think Ms. Shellbach. Just looking back at the chart, she was referencing Florida, and I note that that program did not have any delay in the tax credit. And so I think, you know, just hearkening back to Representative Downey and Mr. Cassidy's testimony, that, you know, this is drafted so to kind of guard against, I think, that, you know, quick investment to make a buck thing that perhaps happened if indeed those things did occur in Florida. And I don't know, because I haven't read those studies, but just I wanted members to be aware of that.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Any other questions, members? Anyone else who would like to testify? Anyone in the audience for or against the bill? With that, I will renew my motion that House File 288, as amended, be recommended to pass and send it on to the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 288 is passed.
Thank you.
Congratulations,
Chair,
Representative Downey. Members, with that, we are adjourned.